Hey everyone, Will Cooper here, host of Hunt Stand's Make Your Mark podcast. Join us as we dive deep into the world of hunting and outdoor pursuits. We've brought together some of the most accomplished individuals in the industry to share their invaluable insights and experiences with you. But here's the kicker. It's not just about hunting tips and tactics. We're exploring how you can carve your own path, elevate your skills, and gain some wisdom from the best in the field. So whether you're a seasoned hunter looking to fine-tune your skills or a newbie eager to learn, our podcast has something for everyone. Stay tuned for more exciting guests and hotter topics. Don't miss out and subscribe to Hunt Stand's Make Your Mark podcast today and start making your mark in the great outdoors.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Everyone, thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Bowhunter Chronicles podcast brought to you by Huntworth. Huntworth bringing you quality hunting clothing and packs at a price you deserve. Check them out at huntworthgear.com. Now, we are heading into the July 4th weekend. If you have not taken your bow out of the case, do so immediately. This podcast is talking about just that, about bow maintenance, about things you can do that you should be doing to keep your bow in good condition, checking your strings, going over all that stuff so that the bow shop guy isn't overwhelmed at the 2 days before season when you got your bow out and you said, oh my God, I think we need to do this. I think we need to change something, all that stuff. We talk draw weights for hunting. We talk high-end bows, mid-range bows, price point bows, difficult bows to work on, all the things, that the questions that I had, before I had a John, to kind of walk me through and explain everything to me. Our guest today, Derek Vaughn, is named the Wizard. Many, previous podcast guests, Derek works on their bows. Derek's a great hunter. We talk about hunting, things to be doing this time of year, some of his thoughts on his style of hunting, all of that sort of thing. But this podcast, like I said, is for all you guys who are, you know, trying to figure out, do I need a new bow? What's is my bow too old? What's too old? What do I need? Maybe I want to go down and draw weight, those types of things. Those are all things that we cover on this podcast, and it was a good conversation. I think you guys are going to like it. Got to give a shout out, like I said, to all of our sponsors, Huntworth being one of them. We're coming up, going to be no podcast next week because of the holiday. July 4th falls on a Tuesday, so I won't be putting out an episode Tuesday. So, but we are going to be giving away that Black Hunter bow. I'm going to get that ordered. I'm going to order one for the shop here and then one to give away. We're going to get that out to Carl. He is going to tune it up, do all of that fun stuff. And I'm thinking maybe we'll get on with like an Instagram Live or something talk through what he did to the bow, kind of the ins and outs of it, and we'll announce our winner. How do you win? That's a great question. I'm still working on that, but we'll get to that with the next podcast. I will have that announcement for you. But we're going to be giving away one of those Black Hunter bows. We got tons and tons of giveaways coming up once we get back with the next podcast. Huntworth gives away one of their packages, usually like a Shelton hoodie or and some Durham pants, or perhaps maybe some of their early season gear. But I think that's probably what I'll push for. That's some of my favorite gear. Latitude's giving away a set of their sticks again. Lucky Buck with either the Lucky Buck or the Seed. And the Bucks are going crazy for that down in Missouri and in Ohio as well. Great stuff. Haven't got any pictures. Don't have any cameras out in the UP. I'm going to be getting up there in August and kind of seeing how the Vitalized Seed is coming along and seeing how everything is going on that front. And set of arrows from Zinger. And Kanadi, those guys. And I got to get with Austin. We're going to be doing a podcast with him very shortly with Genesis 3D. But that hip pinch eliminator, you know, that solo arrow quiver, lots of new products. I got to get a video made for one of the other products that I'm super excited about. I keep talking about it. Not the new one that he's releasing. Go over to Genesis 3D and check that one out. But also, Spartan Forge has got, they give away one of their pro packages, so a year subscription to that. Imagery is great. Lots and lots of new stuff. If you're following along with the Mobile Hunters Expo, there was a lot of new features being show and told down there. So check out SpartanForge.ai. You can sign up there using code Bowhunter and save 25%. That helps us out of the show. But all that stuff is stuff that we give away for our Patreons, as well as hopping onto the Marco Polo group. And if you're not in the Marco Polo group, I would definitely recommend heading over there. It was double duty. Just got back from the property, getting ready to go up there for camping, but clearing everything out, making some more improvements on our camp spot for the Patreon hunt. Did some scouting, you know, driving around, glassing, looking around tonight on the way home, and pretty excited for that, and looking forward to the season. This podcast should get you ready, starting that thought process. Like 4th of July weekend is what I'm told most people, that's where they make the switch to whitetail, and you should definitely be doing that. Get your bows out. Go shoot more arrows. As always, thanks for listening. Hey, everybody. Adam back with another episode of the Bow Hunter Chronicles podcast. And I think every time I've talked to anybody that isn't from like our area about bows or bow tuning or anything like that, this guy's name comes up. And it's from the hunting side. It's from the bow tuning side. I believe he's unofficially called the Wizard. It's Derek Vaughn from Sunrise Archery. Going to be talking with him today about some hunting, about some bow type things. But how are you doing tonight, Derek? Is that a pretty fair assessment?
You got the gist of it. I'm doing good. How are you?
Not too bad. It was finally got some rain over here on the west side of the state. So, people were happy about that. I worked today and then came home, had a little bit of time before the podcast. And my daughter's like, well, what do you want to do? And I'm like, well, do you want to shoot your bow? So we came down and she's shooting her bow. And she said this for anybody, you know, who has daughters or is like has a young daughter and is like, oh, man. You know, for me, I knew I was going to have a daughter because of like all of the hunting and like masculine stuff, and it's like, oh, am I gonna have a tomboy? Am I gonna push him into this hunting stuff? Today my daughter says, yeah, let's go shoot our bows. I'm gonna put my high heels on so I'm taller so I can see the target better. So we definitely have not done that. So
yeah, I don't know how that goes. I have three daughters, so I feel you there.
Yeah, so I think, you know, for her, it's like she just wants to be around. And while I was shooting, she found one of my releases. And so she's on the shot trainer right now upstairs. She's like, can I bring this upstairs? And I'm like, yeah, but I'm like, that's a $200 or $300 release. So just don't lose it. She's like, well, I don't want to break it. I'm like, you're not going to break it. I'm not worried about that. Just don't lose it. So that's all. But so why do all these people keep pointing me to you? Like, what's so special about your shop and what you guys do over there?
Oh, well, I think the big thing for me personally is just the experience. You know, I've been doing this a long time. Started in the late 90s working on bows in a shop in Waterford called KD Outdoors, actually right before I graduated high school. So I've been doing it basically my whole life. I'm kind of a unique age in my early 40s where I'm old enough to have seen a lot of those outdated bows, yet young enough to kind of keep up with the times and, you know, evolve as the bows have evolved over the years and stuff's going on. So I guess I'm just really well equipped to handle, you know, any situation when it comes to archery as far as setting up bows or working on stuff. There's nothing that really surprises me a whole lot anymore when I see it. So I can usually figure out, you know, if there's an issue, how to fix it, you know, maybe what to recommend for a certain customer based on, you know, what I've seen in the past, stuff like that. Just a lot of experience, you know. And then we got a couple of good young guys at the shop, you know, that I was fortunate enough to hire the last few years. They complement me well and they work well together, complement each other well, you know, well. So we just have a good mix. Good mix of the shop. I mean, we're not real pushy, you know, we try to carry as many lines as we can. If we believe in it and we believe they make a good product, we'll sell it, but we don't push it, you know, so nobody feels pressured to buy anything in the shop. Just a really laid back atmosphere. And I think it makes people really comfortable, whether they're a beginner, never shot a bow in their life, or, you know, they're a pro for that, you know, for that standpoint.
So how did you get started, or like what is with your hunting history, and then how did that kind of move into working on bows and stuff?
Well, my dad and grandfather hunted, you know, so I was around hunting from, you know, as young as I can remember. You know, started shooting a bow, I don't know, 6 to 8 years old, somewhere in that time frame. You know, and started hunting as soon as I could. Back then, you couldn't deer hunt until you were 12. They had an age limit back then. And I actually ended up killing my first buck with a bow opening day when I was 12 years old. So I kind of started right out of the gate, you know, having some success. Just fell in love with it. I think around 15 or so, I kind of started doing my own thing as far as scouting and not just relying on my dad to put me on a spot all the time. Started reading sign, learning sign, hanging my own stands, doing my own scouting, that kind of stuff. And really from that year, had immediate success on my own and just kind of evolved from there.
I guess I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you, what was that bow?
My first bow?
Yep.
I killed a deer. It was an XI Silverhawk in 1992.
Okay. Was that a new bow or was that an old hand-me-down?
I think my dad bought it new, I believe. Honestly, don't even remember. I think it was a newer bow at that time. Newish, at least. Let's just say that. It wasn't old at that time. It was fairly new.
So my first year bow hunting was right about that same time. So it would have been 93 when I was hunting the first year. And my first bow was a yard sale, actually, like out of the classifieds. And I had my choice of an old PSE Spirit or the Bear Whitetail 2. So yeah. The one that still had the extra wheels and all the other stuff, had the metal cables and stuff. So that about the same era, but my bow was definitely not new.
I think every one of my buddies had a Dart and Trailmaster. And I think I was about the only one who didn't have. My brother had a Golden Eagle Sparrowhawk.
My brother had a Golden Eagle. I don't remember what it is. It's still hanging in my dad's shop. But my other brother had a Darton 3800. That was that was brand new, and I was so jealous because I was like, he got a new bow, you know, and he's 2 years younger than me. So, but how did you end up working on them? Like, did it start right there from the beginning, or did your dad do any of that stuff?
Well, I think my dad kind of put the word in about me getting a job at the shop there in the late 90s. But that shop was a bigger fishing tackle bait shop than it was an archery shop. I mean, they did have an archery shop, and it kind of grew once I got there. I mean, we had Matthews. That's when Matthews was making their first big push. So we sold a lot of Matthews bows out of there. We had a couple other lines, but yeah, at first I didn't really work on. They had some guys that, were the techs there. And there was one guy in particular, his name was Eric, that kind of took me under his wing a little bit and started showing me stuff that, maybe a couple of the other guys weren't doing, because I think he knew that I had kind of a natural tape to it, was a quick learner, picked up on stuff. And, just started, gradually started doing more. And, within a year or so, I was, probably one of their better bow techs in there. Ended up being there for about 5 years, and just kind of grew as I went. You just learn stuff. The more you work on it, the more you see stuff. I guess I just had a natural instinct of what to do in certain situations to make stuff work, or fix a certain issue. It's hard to describe. It's some guys, I've seen a lot of guys in the shop. Some guys just have a natural instinct, and some guys, show them, 5 or 6 times before they pick up on it.
So at what point did you think that, or did it end up being like this was going to be your career?
Oh, that's a tough question, because I bounced around. I was there. I actually worked in a box store, Gander Mountains, for a couple different Gander Mountains for a while. And then, archery stuff there, we had it, but it was limited on what we could get, what we could sell, and what we were able to do. I actually got hired by a small pro shop over this side of the state. And it was a short stint. I was only there for about a year and a half, but I probably learned more in that year and a half, because it was a small shop and I had a lot of time by myself to tinker and try stuff. And I was at the point where, bows were starting to get more advanced. And I had some equipment that I was able to use that really helped me study and learn what changed, how much the let off would change if you did this, how much speed you'd gain if you did that, a lot of different things. And that's really, when somebody ever first called me that, what you called me earlier, the wizard, somebody kind of made a joke about it. And for a while, it was kind of just like a funny joke. And then after a while, honestly, I think more on the hunting side of it, it just kind of started sticking. So now I got shirts that my wife's made me, the kid that made me and that and everything. So at this point, I guess it's stuck. So I was going to say, to answer your question though, I kind of was, rambling on there, but I went back to Gander after that small shop didn't really pan out, and I was approached by a guy that was going to start the shop here where we're at now. And he said, I'd like to start an archery shop. And he's like, I want you to be me. You've worked on the stuff in the past, and you're good. People respect you in this area. So he reached out to me to see if I'd be interested. And at the time, I was a manager, at a bigger company. Felt pretty secure there, kind of thought maybe that could be my future there, possibly had leads to be, potentially a store manager someday. So I felt like it was a big risk to leave a place like that to go to a pro shop, end up having a meeting with him and his uncle, it'd be two owners, and was just kind of blown away at their vision for their archery shop and what they had in mind, and decided that, it sounded like it was going to be a lot more fun than what I was doing. It was really what I liked to do, and just went for it. And, kind of the rest is history. You can say, from that standpoint, it's just been, fantastic. And, I'll be honest with me, at the time, it had Gander Mountain was out of business in 2 years. So, I thought I was taking a risk, but in reality, it was really the right decision.
So what I was going to say is you come at this from a really, interesting standpoint, on both sides of the coin. And obviously, I mean, I'm pretty objective, but I understand that you could be biased, right? So I gotta ask questions like the devil's advocate in some ways. So one of the things, my father-in-law, he used to work at the shop here in town. And like when Cabela's, I mean, and we see they're all different magazines now, but it used to be that bit, right? When it first came out, it was that Cabela's super thick book, right? And guys would go in there before there was Cabela's everywhere. It was, you know, kind of like a mail order thing. And they'd pick his brain. They'd go in there and they'd ask him all the questions and about all the equipment. He'd take all the time and then they'd go home and order it, you know, cause they'd get their Cabela's points or whatever. And then the, from the same perspective now today with the internet and all of this, you know, where you can go try and find it and things like that. What is the main difference from like a big box store to a little shop? You know, cause it's supporting the little guy, supporting the person. And then at the same point, I mean, you know, gained this reputation working, through different bow shops and then ended up in a big box store. But you know, you can go to Dick's Sporting Goods or you can go to Cabela's and you can buy a bow or you can have them, you know, somewhat set up your bows. Like, what's your take on that experience? Like going into a place like that and buying a bow? Cause literally, I was just reading, some horror story about some string stop being really messed up on a bow and, you know, it got locked open and exploded on a guy and it's like, oh, yep, Cabela's adjusted my bow and all this stuff. So you, coming from that world into where you're at now and kind of bouncing around, like, what's your take on that?
It's a tough call. You really gotta, I would be cautious going to a box store. I would get to know the personnel before I trusted somebody at a place like that to work on your bows. Obviously, you know, I was there at one point. I knew what I was doing. We had a couple other guys there that were actually pretty good techs as well. But I have seen a lot of really bad stuff come from places like that. You know, guys that just shouldn't be working on bows in general. And I think, you know, I started at Gander Mountain and they had, you know, actually pretty substantial archery. We fletched arrows. We even crested arrows. I mean, literally painted arrows there, which, you know, hardly any shops even do anymore. So it was actually, you know, had a bow, you know, a tech area, you know, big counter. We had a lot of bows and we had two or three good guys, but now, you know, as I was there over the years, they shrunk it and it became less service, more get the sale, get them out, you know, kind of mentality.
Have you ever been overwhelmed by the hundreds of food plot seed mixes out there? Well, you are not alone. And Vitalize Seed has developed a seed program that takes the guesswork out of food plotting. Vitalize Seed has two core mixes, the Nitro Boost and Carbon Load, to keep it simple. Nitro Boost is their spring-summer food plot mix, and Carbon Load is the fall plot mix, each having a diverse mix of over a dozen different seed types that are highly attractive to whitetail. Food plotting made simple, but it gets even better. Each mix provides necessary nutrients to the soil, making for better plots each season and saving you money by needing less Roundup and less fertilizer each season. The 1-2 system simplifies your food plots just how nature intended. Vitalize Seed, make biology work for you. Order now at vitalizeseed.com.
Which is unfortunate because you really need that personal connection. You need to understand and get to know the customer you're working with in the shop, because there's drastically different needs from one customer to the next. One guy can just have a, you know, quick setup, get him out the door, and that's all he wants. Another guy needs hours, you know, set up, you know, understanding why he's buying this, why he's buying this arrow. So there's a lot of nuances and stuff that you have to know. And I don't know, the box store though, I mean, there's good guys in box stores. There are, I mean, like I said, I was there. You just got to get to know them and trust them before you allow them to do it, I guess, if that's your only option. If you have the option to use a pro shop, you know, I generally would recommend going that route for a bow purchase myself, but I wouldn't rule the box store out completely.
And so the other part of that question kind of is like, how has, you know, in the last 20 years, the internet affected like your job in the industry and the customer themselves?
Well, I mean, it it helps and it hurts. I mean, it allows people to see stuff and get stuff that they can't get because, you know, we can't have everything. It's just not possible. Now, I'd like to think we could order most things archery-related, but I get there's a time restraint. You know, sometimes there's a price. They can get a good deal on something online. I understand that. But, you know, if they do that, they got to understand if they need help with that item. They have to pay for the time to have it installed properly or leveled, tuned, whatever it may be. So, you know, I don't know. It's like I said, it's something all shops fight, you know, because a lot of people do. They'll come in the shop, they'll look at three or four, you know, handheld releases we got in the shop, they leave, and then the next time you see them, they got one of the releases you showed them, and you know they didn't buy it from you. So sometimes you just, you know, you just got a pill you got to swallow and move on and, you know, help them the best you can, knowing that they're going to come back if you were nice and helpful. And, yeah, like I said, do the best you can. The good thing is, you know, the bows are pretty protected. There's not a lot of bows, at least new bows. I am not high unless it's used. So that's the one thing that, you know, some of the archery brands have tried to help us out a lot with is, you know, trying to protect the pro shops the best they can.
Now, this may be a difficult question to answer. So I don't want you to, like, you can speak freely here. This is a safe space, right? But with the internet and all of that, and we'll you can feel however you want about this particular example, but like with the Ranch Fairy stuff and all of that, like, has the internet created these like know-it-alls that come into the shop and they tell you what you're going to do? And have you seen more of that? And how does that affect, like, your customer service, we'll call it?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. That, you know, right during COVID, when I was in that, you know, Ranch Fairy stuff really took off. And I think we sold more heavy broadheads and more heavy inserts and heavy arrow builds in that 1 year than we did in the previous 6 or 7 years combined. And, you know, that lasted, I don't know, a year, year and a half, where it was real hot and heavy. And then it started, a lot of those guys started coming back a little bit, you know, kind of found a happy medium between where they used to be and there. Because, you know, there are some benefits, you know, we can go on and on about whether that's the right way to do it or not. I'm not a big proponent of crazy heavy arrows. I used to shoot what was considered a fairly heavy arrow, and now it's not, you know, so because of all that. So I definitely am a proponent of a moderately heavy arrow, but not excessive. But yeah, for sure. I mean, archery talk's another one, you know, where everybody comes in and they read something on them. It's like gospel, you know, there's no way fans or butts. That's a fact, you know, whatever they read on there that somebody else told them. So you just, you know, we're pretty flexible. I'm never going to tell a guy no. You know, if he wants me to build him an 800 grain arrow, I'm going to build him an 800 grain arrow. If he wants my opinion on what arrow he should, you know, hunt with, I'm not going to recommend an 800 grain arrow for whitetail. I'm just not going to do it. But if that's what he wants to do, I will do.
And then how does that affect, like, your tuning and all of that stuff? Does it just create a lot more work for you? Like, what guys want this, you know, your example, 800 grain arrow?
Well, what we saw a lot of were guys with price point bows, you know, that didn't have the tuning options that some of the higher end bows do, wanting to build that kind of setup. And that did create some long, you know, some long tuning sessions at the shop. You know, a bow that might have normally taken a half hour to tune, you know, and I had to spend an hour and a half, 2 hours on it. Just because there's a lot of variables when you put that much weight on the front of the arrow, you know, with a bow that you don't have a lot of tuning issues with, you know. So, but I mean, it's part of the job. It's what we're there for, you know, to problem solve and, you know, make people happy. And, you know, sometimes it was fun, sometimes it was frustrating. You know, it just depends on the day and how many people were waiting to get, you know, waiting behind that person, you know.
So I don't want this to necessarily be just about arrow building, but I think that it goes kind of, it could go hand in hand. You could be, you could take it a completely different direction, but, from your perspective and I want to talk about, like, how the bows have evolved and things like that. But for your average Midwest hunter, we're not going out west
you know, maybe we'll take an out of state trip. You know, maybe we shoot a tack event or something like that, for bow setups. And when you're getting ready, and as now we're coming, you know, through, you know, unfortunately, I would say the majority of people, maybe you have a better idea about this, you know, haven't even taken their bows out of their cases yet, or they're just starting to dust them off and say, oh, well, you know, it's 4th of July. Maybe it's time to start thinking about whitetails. When you're setting up your bow, or as far as components, or, you know, getting ready for the season, what are some of the like most underrated things that guys can do? And then the most overrated, where people focus too heavily on?
I don't know. That's a tough question. Like, we just, the underrated part, I would say, you got to start earlier. I mean, you're like you said, there's way too many guys that wait till September. You know, we get guys come in middle of September, bow that needed strings 2 years ago, you know, and they want it done by October 1st. That's frustrating. It's hard to say. Just start shooting early. There's no better time than now. You know, we ran a special the whole month of June on strings and cables, just to try to pre-mold that, getting ready early, try to beat the rush, and to try to spread out the curve for us as far as the busy season and service, that kind of stuff. So I don't know. And as far as overrated, I don't know. I don't know that you can ever work too much or worry too much about one thing. That's a tough question for me. I really don't want to answer that, to be honest with you.
Well, I see guys that go into this like, and I don't want to like single anybody out, but that, you know, if all their arrows aren't perfectly tuned, then they're just not going to hunt. Or if they're, you know, they're not, you know, they have a bad day of shooting or something, it's like, well, you know, it's time to, you know, I saw something on like a meme. I think one of our Patreons, Brad, put it out there, but it was a guy who said, you know, I got all my broadheads and field points hitting right where they're supposed to be at 60 yards. Time to mess with my bow, right? Like, that it's never good enough. You got to keep tinkering, right?
There are a lot of guys that do too much tinkering, that's for sure. I mean, they'll shoot one day and, you know, shoot really well. The next time they go out, they're not shooting so good, so they want to change something. I would definitely avoid that, because, you know, I think, you know, we're humans. Sometimes we just have a bad day. If you're starting to have a bad day, maybe just put the bow down and take a break. You know, wait till the next day when you're feeling better, shooting better.
One of the most legendary shows in the outdoors is on Waypoint TV. Don't miss Primo's Truth About Hunting, Wednesday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment.
I'm Will Cooper, host of Hunt Stand's Make Your Mark podcast. For even more content, be sure to watch the original films from Hunt Stand Presents on the Waypoint TV channel every Tuesday at 10 p.m. Eastern. Visit waypointtv.com to learn more.
I've been a victim of that myself. You know, once in a while, I won't shoot for a week, then I go to shoot and something doesn't quite seem right, so I'm quick to say something changed, and it's really just, I haven't shot in a while, you know, just be patient, stick to your form, you know, trust it. You've done it for a long time. But at the same time, you know, I don't want people to be afraid to try new things, you know, because there have been a lot of advancements. I mean, there's a lot of guys that get stuck in their ways with old equipment. You know, this is my release. I've used it for 25 years. You know, this is, I'm just used to it. Releases have gotten better. You know, arrows, you know, guys still want to shoot aluminum arrows. Well, there's better options. And, well, these things penetrate better than carbons. I don't think they do. You know, you can make a carbon that's heavier than an aluminum, you know, if you want to. So, you know, there's just a lot of stuff like that. But the biggest thing is confidence. Whatever you're going to do, be confident in it. You know, it's just kind of like fishing. I always use the, you know, comparison. You might be fishing with a buddy, both using the same lure. One guy's catching the crap out of him, but the other guy's not catching anything, because one guy's got all the confidence in the world in that bait, and the other guy doesn't. And that's all it really boils down to.
You talk about like the older equipment stuff, and that was one of the things on my list to talk about, is like in the last 10 years, or, and even you could go to like the last 5 or 6 years. Like, what have you seen? And I understand that you're in the business of selling bows, but like, what have been like the major advancements? What makes a bow today better than a bow that was made 10 years ago or 5 years ago or 2 years ago? Because there's these guys that just need to get a new bow. And I feel like those, the guys that are doing that aren't the price point bow guys like you're talking about. They're the, you know, high end bow, you know, got to have the flagship model every year. But that aside, what are the major differences in say 5 and 10 years ago?
Yeah, the biggest thing for me, you know, if you look at bows on paper from 10 years ago, like if you look at a spec sheet, axle-to-axle, the speed, the brace height, when you look at the bows of today, nothing's really changed. They're all still shooting about the same speeds, similar size. They weigh about the same. But what they've done, you know, the biggest thing in my opinion is the efficiencies, how smooth they draw, higher let-offs, less hand shock, less vibration, quieter, that kind of stuff. And then and the other thing is the integration that's going on with these bows where they're becoming complete systems. And I don't want to like keep tooting Matthews on specifically. You know, we're a big Matthews dealer. I like Matthews a lot, but there's a lot of other bows I like, but they're kind of at the forefront of that, making the whole bow, you know, a system. You know, they got a sight that fits that bow specifically. They got a rest that's made just for that bow. They've got a stabilizer that fits that bow, quiver that fits that bow. And guys like that stuff. They don't want stuff to match and all go together and fit well and look good. And they've done that. You know, Hoyt's done it. PSE's working. You know, they're all kind of following that and that kind of trend. So I think, you know, the smooth draws, the hand shock, the vibration, and then the integration, fit and finish, you know, just as a system are the biggest things that have changed in the last 5 to 10 years, in my opinion.
And so I think I know what you're talking about, but can you explain efficiency? Because I would think that like being efficient would lead to higher speeds, right? But we're kind of staying there. We can't break that wall, and maybe we shouldn't, but yeah. What does the efficiency mean?
So basically, if you're getting 350 on a bow now versus a bow that was getting 350, you know, 10 years ago, the bow getting 350 now probably has more let off and draws an easier draw cycle, you know, to get that same kind of number, if that makes sense. You're not having to put as much energy into it. Easier to hold, easier to aim.
Okay.
But some of the bows that were shooting 360, 370, some of the, you know, full throttles and stuff like that, the PSE had, they had, you know, really short valleys. They were tough to shoot. Some guys really liked them because they had, you know, they liked that high holding weight. They pull in the wall. A guy like myself that's more of a static shooter, I don't pull real hard through the back end of the shot. I just never have shot that way and never been comfortable shooting that way. That kind of bow just eats me alive. I don't have a little bit of valley, you know, or let off is what I prefer. So
that's the million-dollar question, right? You said, well, you know, some guys like it this way. I'm not that kind of shooter. You know, in our groups, we have guys that want to know, like, well, what's the best bow out there? Like, what's the best bow at this price? What's the best? And, you know, in podcast land, you said you don't listen to very many podcasts, but the very cliche answer, right, is it's situational. And so the very cliche answer is, well, you just got to go shoot them all. All right. Well, maybe your dealer doesn't have all of them. Maybe your buddy doesn't have all your buddies shoot Matthews and you can't afford a Matthew. So you're trying to figure out like what's going to get me that. So what do those different things mean? If you can't shoot them all, but like the bows that have like a spongy back wall or, you know, string stops versus draw stops versus all that stuff, like, can you tell us a little bit about like that? So if you're just reading a spec sheet, like what can you expect maybe out of some of these terms or whatever?
Yeah. I mean, it is cliche, but you know, I always recommend, unless somebody has a specific bow in mind when they come into the shop, if they come in and they say, you know, do you have XYZ bow? Yeah. They shoot it. They like it. That's the bow I want to sell. Now, if they come in with an open mind and they give me a price point, you know, I have them shoot a bunch of different bows. Usually, I can tell right away what they kind of like in a bow, and I'll rule a couple out and give them a couple other options. But as far as the whole, you know, limb stop versus cable stop, you know, spongy wall, solid wall, that basically, you know, if you're a more of a back tension type shooter, regardless of the style of release where you're pulling through the shot, you probably want a cable stop or something that has a little bit of give to it, because you need a little bit of movement to keep the pin steady, basically. Because if you're pulling hard against, say, a limb stop wall where there's no movement whatsoever, it's that rock hard wall, something has to give. So if you're pulling hard on that wall, usually the give is on your front arm in the pin movement. So more of a static shooter will like that rock hard wall, high let off, no movement. Whereas if it's somebody that's pulling through the shot, making a good strong shot, more like a tournament shooter, basically, you typically are always going to recommend cable stop bow that's got a little bit of give. Not really a soft wall, because none of the high end bows really have a soft wall, but something with a little bit of cushion.
So when you're talking about let offs and efficiency and some of this, those types of things, you get into this kind of like weird spot now, because we've got like 90% let off bows, like these bows that are just, you know, you can hold them forever. And then you kind of get to the question of like, what is a good weight for deer? Like, can I kill deer with 55 pounds? Is that enough? You know, you go to tack and you're trying to shoot, you know, 140 yards with a 50 pound bow. Well, forget about it. Right. But practically for whitetails and kind of what, you know, what's our bread and butter, you know, what do you tell guys from that standpoint, as far as like, you know, draw weight for hunting?
A lot of that depends on their draw length. So like for kids, you know, with short draw lengths, I try to push them to get to close to 40 as they can. But if you're dealing with a woman or an older guy that's got a, you know, 29, 30 inch draw, that's a huge advantage over a kid with a, you know, 22, 23 inch draw. They could probably kill a deer with 30, 35 pounds. You know, my wife shoots 45 ish pounds, and she's had pass-throughs on a couple mature bucks with fixed blade heads in the last 3-4 years. So, I mean, 40s, I mean, with the newer technology, is, you know, unless you're a really, really short draw, 40s more than adequate to kill a deer. But if you have a longer draw, like I said, I mean, even less than that, you know, with the new bows, how efficient they are and how good they shoot.
And so when guys are worried about shooting, you know, 50 pounds or anything like that, that's, you know, nothing to be worried about.
I tell people all the time, you can kill any animal in North America with 50 pounds. With the right arrow set up, right broadhead, I mean, you can kill an elk or a moose with 50 pounds. I mean, would I recommend shooting more? Absolutely. But if that's all you're capable of shooting, we get, you know, obviously the big question is, you know, am I going to have to go to a crossbow, you know, kind of thing, you know, when they start dipping the poundage. You know, that's at their discretion, but, you know, 50 pounds is way more than enough to kill a whitetail.
So from a bow perspective, and, you know, like some shop stories or whatever, like what's the worst bow that you've ever had to work on?
Oh man. I mean, I don't know. I mean, probably your old whitetail too that you were, you know, debating about picking up back in the day. I mean, there's been a lot of really old stuff. I mean, anytime we see something like that and they're trying to put money or work into it, we always, you know, kind of lead with, hey, you know, this bow will work, you know, it'll do the job, but, you know, the money you're going to put into it is more than it's worth, you know, and you may be better served putting that into whether it's a new price point bow or something used or, you know, something more modern. I can't put it, you know, a specific one bow that was the worst, but anything that's, you know, especially pre-mid-90s, I would say, you know, at this point, you're getting to the point where it's not worth putting any money into.
Well, I'm just wondering from like the newer era of bows where like you get this bow and you're like, why do they do it this way? Why do I have to like when this bow comes into the shop, because there's a, you know,
I'll say Oneidas in general. That's the one bow that I would say if it came in and it really needed an overhaul, I, you know, maybe the one bow that I would say, you know what, I might not be able to figure this one out. Just because of the type of presses needed and all the stuff you need to actually work on when I'm not super familiar with them. I've worked on several, done many strings over the years. We used to sell them in the shop I worked at, you know, pulling them like that, sell the scopes. But that's, I guess, the one style of bow or bow that I just, when I see one come through the door, I kind of cringe. Is anything wrong with them? You know, they draw nice. They do the job. I just, that's the one bow that I would say I'm definitely not an expert at working on.
So that's just not in your wheelhouse as a, you know, it's not your favorite.
Pretty much.
So, what is the deal with the price point bows? Because, you know, a lot of them, they shoot really good. The prices are there. They're not, you know, they're not winning any awards by, you know, social media or guys out there. I mean, like for me, the bow that I shoot, and I've shot the platform for the last 5 to 7 years, I think, but I'm shooting the Carbon Zion right now. And for myself, like doing this podcast, like John has a V3X, like he got a V3X, he shot the NTN, he had whatever Bowtex like high end bow was the before he got that one, and we could have had any bow that we wanted to, and like I shot that bow, it was comfortable for me, it's light, it's easy for him to work on, and it doesn't cost a lot of money, and I wanted to kind of show guys that, you know, you don't have to have a flagship bow or a new bow every year. And my bow is a freaking tool. Like it's all rusty and there's very little maintenance that I do to it. I'm probably the guy that you look at the bow and you go, okay, this is going to be a couple hours on the bench instead of a couple minutes, but it works for me. And it's just a tool for me. It's not winning any beauty contests, right?
Yeah. I mean, you definitely don't need the high end bow to kill a deer. No question about it. I mean, it's a luxury for sure. And that bow you have, that platform, you know, started with the Carbon Knight. That's probably been like the second year we were there. So maybe 9 years ago, they come out with the Carbon Knight, give or take. And then they evolved into the Carbon Icon and then the Zion. And I bet you we've sold 500 to 1,000 of that platform over the years. With not very many issues. Now, when they tried to push that riser into a high-end cam, we saw quite a few issues with, you know, riser twist and stuff like that. When they tried to do that Carbon Overdrive bow, that didn't really work out that well. But on that platform, it's been pretty rock solid. I would say, you know, what separates that from like the high-end, you know, if you want to compare it to other carbon bows, is that it's an injection, you know, like a mullet riser, you know, pulling it into a mullet, almost kind of like a plastic type of carbon versus like a bike frame carbon, like PFC or Hoyt, you know, tubular carbon, that kind of thing. And then it just doesn't have a lot of options for tuning outside of moving the rest around, you know, which a lot of the newer bows, you can leave the rest down the middle, tune elsewhere. So that would be the only other, I guess, drawback, you know, and some of the components, you know, compared to the bows aren't as high, but, you know, great bow for the money. And we, like I said, we've probably sold 500 to 1,000 of them over the last 10 years.
But, so middle of the road or price point bows as a rule, It would that be pretty standard, just as like maybe a lack of tuning or just a little bit of old technology? I mean, what's really holding them back?
It's the components, you know, the limb pockets rather than a machine aluminum to super tight tolerance might be a, you know, a plastic Delrin, you know, whatever injected product that, you know, has a little bit of, you know, loose tolerances. Just, you know, the tuning features, you know, most of them have, you know, your typical cable slide rather than cable, whether it's a flat start or roller guard, you name it. They just, you know, they skimp where they can. They still feel good. They shoot good. You know, if you look at the specs, like you said, they're comparable with a lot of the high-end stuff. They might have a little bit more hand shock, a little bit more vibration. That's not the case with all of them. You know, some of the, you know, when you get into the really price point bows, I'm talking, you know, more like the $400 or $500 range. You get the really spongy bowls on some of them. They're just cheaper in areas, in some critical areas, but it doesn't mean they won't get the job done.
And what does that mean to the like end user? Like, I guess, is it that much? I can tell you, like, so that I've got a Bear Alaskan, and it's different than the Carbon Zion, but it's really spongy. I mean, like, super spongy. Like, you can tell, like, that's a one thing. It's a great shooting bow. I like the way that it draws. I like the draw cycle. I like all that stuff. That sponginess is one thing I would say about it. But to the end user, like, what does it matter if it feels good in your hand? Like, if you don't shoot that bow next to a Phase 4, does it really matter?
Well, the feel in your hand is the most overrated aspect of all of archery. In archery sales, in my opinion. Because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what it feels like when in your hand when it goes off. Where does the arrow go? So it's all about repeatability, you know. So if they can do the same thing over and over and over and over and not change, that's what you want. You know, and some of the price point bows is what I'm talking about with the tolerance. It's over time, if there's a little bit of loose tolerance and then, you know, can shift in the pocket slightly over time, you know, that could be an issue down the road. I'm not saying this happens. It's a possibility. But at the end of the day, I mean, the arrow goes where it's supposed to go. It doesn't matter what it came out of, you know.
So in that scenario, how would a guy at home like notice that, or what would you see other than just saying, like we kind of led with saying, okay, well, maybe it was just a bad day. Maybe it was, you know, how do we know it was equipment failure? I mean, how often should you be paper tuning your bows and things like that?
I mean, anytime something seems off, it doesn't hurt to have it checked. I mean, whether that's once a month, we get guys come in once a month, want something looked at. Or once a year. I mean, I would at a minimum once a year, I'd have your bow looked over. It doesn't cost anything for, you know, us to look at it. I don't know about other shops, but, you know, we're going to give you an opinion for nothing, you know, based on, you know, if you bring it in, we're going to tell you what you need and we're going to charge you for that. So, but yeah, I mean, you look for signs of wear. You know, if you get an odd wear in a spot on your string that you didn't used to get, or, you know, all of a sudden your cam looks like it's leaning more than it used to, or your limb, you know, maybe you're getting wear on one side of the limb, you can see where it's rubbing in the pocket. You know, any of that kind of stuff. Anything that catches your eye out of the ordinary, you know, I would bring in and have a look at least get an opinion on.
And then, like I said, I am not the bow maintenance guy. I'm the cringy guy that walks in when you see my bow. What are some things that guys should be doing as far as like maintenance that would help them out, but then help you out tremendously?
I mean, the biggest thing is, you know, string wax, but don't overdo it. It seems like guys either never wax their strings or they do it way too much. We get guys that come in with their bows just caked with wax end to end. They wax and then around the cams, you know, areas that don't need wax have wax, and that just encourages, you know, dust and dirt buildup in those areas that don't normally get it. So, you know, really, you know, depending on the conditions you're shooting in, if you're in real dry conditions, dusty, like when we're up at Total Archery, it was real dry and dusty up there. A lot of guys probably could have benefited to wax their strings when they got done with that shoot. But in general, I mean, I'm only waxing my strings, you know, two or three times a year tops, honestly. I mean, it's not that often, but you got to do it periodically. I don't like to do it right before I'm going to go to a shoot, and I don't like to do it right before I'm going to hunt, because it actually adds weight to the strings and can actually change your impact point, you know, especially at the longer yardages. So usually if I'm going to do it, it's, you know, after I'm done with something, you know, after the season, or I'm not going to shoot it for a while, like after tack, maybe I'm not going to shoot for a few weeks, I'll wax it. And then when I start shooting again, I'll, you know, put a new tape on it with a hunting arrow or whatever I'm going to do. But that's the biggest thing. And then, you know, just obviously if you get dusty dirt all over your bow, you know, clean it off, you know, don't let that sit there and, you know, work its way into your cams, your axles, your loom pockets, that kind of stuff. Just common sense stuff like that outside of, you know, the wax.
I'm pretty sure you just said I don't have common sense, but anyway.
Well, I'm sorry if I offended you.
No, I don't have any feelings. But so what about your bow, like frozen into your bow case? Is that bad too?
Yeah, if you get wet, you know, if you get a bow wet, you use a bow case, as soon as you can get it out of there. Do not leave a bow in the case wet. That's a bad thing, and I think it happens probably far too often during the season. You know, you close the case after you're done hunting, you know, hunt for a week, it drizzled on you, you open it up, everything's rusted. You know, that's not a good thing. So definitely get your bow out, dry it off, let it air out, you know, during the season for sure.
And with that string wax, like what is that doing? So I mean, and how should people be like applying it, you know? Because I think string maintenance and like strings in general are things that, like, you know, are perplexing to guys, because it's like, oh, this string's $100 and this string's $200 and string stretch and all this other stuff, right?
I mean, I guess depending on the material, there's probably different recommendations based on what kind of string material you're using. And I'm not a string builder, so I'm not going to go into detail on that. But the biggest thing is you don't want it to dry rot, basically. And that's what happens. Like if the string gets wet in the rain and then dries and then wet and then dries, you know, they start to basically dry rot and start getting that real fuzzy look. That's what you want to avoid. And the wax, you know, actually help, you know, prevent the rain from penetrating it, you know, almost like a, you know, makes the water more bead off it, kind of like a DWR treatment, if that makes sense. But so it just keeps it conditioned, you know, lubricated, you know, if that makes sense.
And so when should guys replace their strings and with what?
Well, that's somewhat of a loaded question, because, you know, you got customer number one that shoots 20 arrows a year, you know, in September and then goes and hunts. And then you got, you know, customer number two that shoots 5,000 arrows a year, you know, and he's probably going to need strings every other year. And the other guy might be able to get 5 or 6 years out of the set, assuming he's, you know, waxing and taking care of them in the off season and that kind of stuff. So it's hard. And then every single bow is harder or less hard on a string. So it depends on what the bow is, how much they shoot, how well they take care of it. But, you know, just in general, like if somebody asks us at the shop, you know, our typical answer is like 2 to 4 years. And again, it's one of those things where bring it in, let us look at it. We're gonna tell you whether we think you need it or not. As far as with what, I mean, we're a huge America's Best Bowstring dealer. I don't know if you're familiar with them or not, but they're our go-to brand for strings. We've actually been their biggest dealer in the country the last 3 years running. So got a lot of luck with them. Their customer service is phenomenal. We've never once had them say no. You know, if somebody ever has a question or doesn't like something about a string, they're going to replace it, no questions asked. They have a good warranty. They stand by it. You know, if we can prove that it was bought within the time of that warranty, they're going to replace it if there's an issue that they feel like you know, was the string's fault. So, you know, a lot of good stuff to say about those guys there.
And so when you're saying, like, if you're the guy that shoots, you know, 100 arrows a year or 5,000 arrows a year, and I mean, other than, you know, bringing it into a shop, but what are some signs that you could look at as yourself when you're shooting, saying, okay, well, maybe it's time for a new string? You know, you don't have a clicker out there every time you shoot an arrow. You're like, well, I shoot a lot, but I don't know if I need one or what.
Usually you'll see serving separation or in and around the cams is usually the first thing that I pick up on. You know, that fuzziness, if it's getting dry rotted, you get that fuzzy look. If it starts doing that too bad, once it gets to that point, you can wax it, it'll hide it for a little bit. And usually it's there, you know, it's going to come right back. So you just start shooting for a while. But biggest thing is, you know, inspect your servings, look around the cams, make sure there's not a big gap or, you know, separating or something's not cut. You know, if you see something hanging loose, you know, that's always a, you know, red flag for sure. And some people, you know, let's face it, they just don't really know what to look for or where to look. So, you know, again, it's one of those things where, you know, bring it to a shop and let somebody who knows what to look for, look at it, give you an opinion.
All right. Well, so I think that covered like most of the questions that I had on the bows. I'm going to take a look here real quick. I guess for you, what are your like favorite bows? I think that's the only other thing is like for like a budget bow, like obviously, you know, you got to go in, you got to shoot it, you got to see how it works for you. But like what bows are you seeing guys have really good success with or
the budget bow price line?
Yeah, like on one of the price point bows and then maybe the higher end bow. I mean, obviously, it sounds like maybe the Matthews is going to be your go-to, but well, regardless.
Like for, you know, like I'd say youth and women, you know, without on the price point side, I like the diamond stuff a lot. We sell missions. We have, you know, PSEs. We got some bears, but the diamond, especially like the Edge XT is a really good one that I like a lot for youth and women, especially youth that are growing because it's got a huge range. And a lot of bows have that huge range. That one seems to be a little bit easier to get set up and tuned correctly. And that mid-range, the bow you have, that Carbon Zion, has been a great one for years. The Hoyt Torx, we sell a lot of those. PSE Drive, Bear's got a couple of that Alaskan. We do pretty well with that. And then they got another one called the Legend XR that they launched this year. It seems to be really nice. So those I would say are probably in that mid range or best ones. And then the high end, I mean, they're all awesome bows. We sell a ton of Matthews, similar to ABB. We're a huge Matthews shop. And you know, be honest with you, more often than not over the last 10 years, I end up not shooting one just because I shoot a different brand better. And then whether that's a PSE or Bowtech or Hoyt, you know, I've shot them all, you know, got a Prime right now that I like a lot. So there's a lot of good bows. Matthews is by far and away our number one seller. I think we've been the number one Matthews dealer in state two of the last 3 years. So obviously, from a brand standpoint, I love them. They do great for the shop. Their accessories are great. But I can't say that their bow any one year is better than, you know, anybody else's bow. Just they sell better. That is a fact for us.
So in the last, I don't know, 3 years, maybe, it seems like we've seen this incredible jump in price. Like, they used to be $1,000 bows. Now you're looking at, you know, the Expeditions or the Carbon bows from PSE. You're looking into $2,000, you know, almost $2,000. What justifies that, or where is that like coming from?
When you go out there and the fish are where you think they are, any one of these casts could be the bite. It's the most exciting fishing that I know, right here at Hawk's Cave.
Oh, that's awesome!
Experience the best saltwater fishing the world has to offer. Don't miss Thursdays with Saltwater Experience, brought to you by Golden Boat Lifts, every Thursday night from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment.
Brave anglers search for the one they call king, but who will take his throne?
Tune in to Waypoint TV's Battle for Silver, Saturday, May 18th from 12 to 6 p.m. Eastern, presented by Abyss Battery. Waypoint TV.
Out of pocket.
Most of those are carbon. Now, the Expedition, we're not a dealer of Expedition. I've seen that bow. I know it's some sort of alloy that's, you know, lighter than aluminum, supposed to be stronger. I picked one up that I actually opened a tack, and they're definitely light. But they, I don't really know about that particular bow, so I'm not really going to talk too much about that one. The carbon bows are basically the other ones that are way up there. Most of the aluminum flagship bows are still 11 or 1200. So they've come up some, and there was definitely a spike from COVID with components and cost of materials and stuff like that. But the big thing with the carbon, I don't know, it's just different. You know, guys want to be different. It's lighter for the most part, especially PSEs are substantially lighter. Hoyts have come down in weight a little bit. The last, you know, when they went from the 5 to the 7, they cut a bunch of weight. You know, Bowtech and Elite have carbon bows now, and they're all in that $1,600 to $1,900 kind of price point. They're more rigid. They have a different feel to them. You know, they don't get cold. The PSE, in the case of the PSE, they are substantially lighter. I guess the thing I like about that is you can put more weight in your stabilizers to influence the way that they aim, I guess, if that makes sense, rather than, you know, and still have a manageable bow weight. So I do like that. But it's hard to justify the cost of them, you know, for your average bow hunter. And most average bow hunters aren't buying those bows. You know, we do well with them, but it's a small percentage of our sales that goes like that.
So, from a guy who, it sounds like got your nickname, the Wizard, from hunting, more on the hunting side, how does working in the shop affect your hunting, and how do you like prioritize your time in the woods versus like your job, you know? So I've prioritized hunting so that I've got a bunch of time off during the rut and during hunting season. But it seems like, you know, an early velvet hunt or something like that is completely off the table for you. Cause that's when these guys are cracking their bow cases open and saying, Derek, I need your help.
It's definitely very, very difficult to manage. Cause I would love to go out west hunting, mostly because of work. I got buddies that started hunting North Dakota last year, the year before. They've had good success in September. They invited me, you know, this year, and I don't think I can make it happen. Maybe someday. But I do, you know, I used to golf a lot. I used to fish a lot, and I used to bow hunt a lot. When I got married, had kids, bow hunting was the one thing that wasn't going, you know, to kind of give up. I basically gave up golfing and fishing for years, and kind of getting back into golfing a little bit now that the kids are a little older, but don't fish nearly as much as I used to. But the bow hunting was always number one for me, and was something that I was, you know, not going to give up. Now I had to, you know, manage that time a little better. Working in the shop, it's definitely tough. But basically, every day I have off, for the most part, you know, I try to keep the wife and kids as happy as possible. But they know, and they understand how much it means to me. So yeah, that end of October through the middle of November timeframe for me, if I'm not at work, I'm usually in the tree. And being the manager at the shop, you know, I've been doing it a long time. You know, pick and choose. I know historically when my best chances are going to be, and try to pick those days and give the other guys some days off as well, because they like to hunt too, of course. But it's tough. It's real tough.
And so, like, how many days a year are we talking that you're in the stand? Because I mean, the time frame that you gave there, you know, let's call it October 20th through, if we're talking, you know, bow hunting, we're talking till November 14th. You've only got a couple of weeks. And then you said, whenever I'm not working. So for a regular person, that's 5 days a week. And if you work in a bow shop, you know, maybe that's the weekend, or maybe that's, you know, so quantity of days, how is that stacking up for you?
I probably, you know, if you want to count the whole season, I probably hunt. That's tough. I got to think about this. I would say 25 or 30 days between October 1st and the end of the season.
Okay. And so
half of those would be like between, I would say, October 27th and November 14th.
Okay. And what are you doing to set yourself up for success? Like, you know, we talked a little bit about it earlier prior to recording that you were hunting some some mostly private land, and you've got some leases and stuff. But how does that work out with, you know, the other guys that you're doing the leases with, where I don't want to say, you know, that your time is more valuable than anybody else's, but if you've only got, you know, so many days or so many opportunities, you know, what are you doing to prioritize? Because, you know, you're doing this at a very high level. As I said, you were recommended to me not only from the bow side, but from the hunting side as well.
Well, I mean, over the years, I've been hunting the same farms in Michigan for the most part. We've lost some and we've gained some, but for, you know, this will be about year 14 I've been involved with this lease. So it's, I'm really big on historical movement, like when, where, and why they move. And it does change from year to year based on just whether there's a good deer in that particular area or not. But, you know, I use cameras a lot. You know, I've evolved from regular cameras where I'm, you know, running 15 regular cameras to now, you know, more 50-50 between cell cams and regular cameras. You know, from about right now, I was actually out hanging cameras last Wednesday, and I'm going to put more out today. So right about mid to late June on, I try to keep really close attention to, you know, what deer are around, where they are. And if I know where they are based on history, I know kind of whether they're vulnerable and when they're vulnerable and what kind of conditions I need to go in after them. I've just had a lot of success because, like I said, my time's limited. So I have to be efficient with my time. And, you know, we were talking about the private and public stuff earlier. That's part of the reason I haven't really dabbled into the public, is just because I don't have the time to afford to burn hunts. I don't have time to go sit and stand for, you know, a day and have three guys walk by and ruin a day of hunt. You know, I only get so many days. So I try to make them as efficient as I can. You know, in early October, if I have a day, I will, I guess, somewhat burn a hunt, you know, maybe to observe. You know, I'm totally out of the game and trying to learn something. But for the most part, you know, most of my success is pre-rut, during the rut, based on historical data that I've learned over the years in certain areas.
So, like, right now, when you're going out there and you're setting cameras and you're, you know, using that, the time that you have right now, what are you focusing on? Like, what are those cameras doing for you in mid October or, you know, early November?
Well, right now I'm spreading them pretty thin, just kind of trying to take inventory. You know, there's a few specific deer that I, you know, from last year that made it through that I'm going to be looking for to see if they're still around. But for the most part, I'm just trying to get a feel for what deer are around and where they are. Basically, compiling a hit list. I usually have a summer hit list that, you know, that might be 15 deer. I have a list of, you know, three and a half year olds or 4.5 year olds or older in Michigan. And then by the time October rolls around, usually that list is cut in half because they just disperse and they're just no longer around. So right now I'm just trying to make as big a list as possible, and try to keep tabs on them from there. You know, if I start getting a lot of good deer in one area, I might put more cameras in an area just to try to hone in on them a little bit more, figure out what they're doing. But I haven't killed a lot of deer early. You know, I have killed a few good bucks. You know, I've killed a couple opening day, and then I have killed a couple pretty good ones right in the middle of October, like in the lull, 15th, 17th, right around that time frame. But for the most part, it's that last few days of October where I really, you know, key in on specific deer. And that, you know, as we get into that, you know, later part of the first week of November, second week of November, I'm more concentrated on travel corridors, you know, bedding areas, that kind of stuff, where it's just historical rut movement, not necessarily targeting a specific deer, just knowing that there's enough good deer in there that, you know, you spend enough time there.
So where are you placing these cameras at this time of year when you say that you're spreading them thin, like from like a from like an inventory standpoint rather than like a kill type spot?
Mostly food sources, edge of bean fields, you know, trails coming in and out of food, you know, that kind of stuff. I will put cell cams in areas that are deep, knowing that I'm not going back in there just to kind of see, you know, what's going on deeper in areas. But for the most part, they're, you know, on edges, mostly edges of fields.
Okay. And so how do you use that information? I know you said that you're compiling like these hit lists and then these deer disappear. So you've been on these same farms for, you know, over a decade. Are you confident that this is just where the deer go when they're pressured, or this is where these deer go for lockdown? Or is it just, you know, like the community scrape type stuff? Because one of the things that you said was, you know, where the deer are vulnerable. So what does that mean, like, to you?
Well, when I say vulnerable, there's one specific farm in mind that it's basically skinny cover. And, you know, if there's a couple bucks or even one good buck using it, and if I get, you know, a northwest wind, I can hit this spot. And if he's there that day, there's a pretty good chance if he moves, he's going to come by. And I happen to kill a deer 3 years in a row out of that same tree. You know, two of them were 140-inch deer in Michigan. So, I mean, it's just proven over time that it works. And then, you know, the last 3 years, I haven't killed a deer. You know, so it's just kind of one of those things where, and basically didn't have deer really using it the last 3 years. There's deer there, but not the deer I wanted to target. So it's just knowing that, you know, if there is a shooter in that spot, in that area, you know, based on history, and if I get the conditions right, there's a decent chance, you know, long assuming I can get home for that day when the conditions are right, that I can, you know, get a crack at them.
So, like you said, you're not much of a podcast listener, so I'll let you know that I'm the world's worst bow hunter, and that's the way that it works out for me. And I've never, like, I can think back on days that I've like killed deer or that I've like capitalized, or some of the days where I've really seen a lot of deer, but I don't look at like the weather and say, okay, here's a cold front, I need a day off. Earlier in my career, I would say I just need to be in the woods every day. Now I'm looking at the winds and things like that. But when you talk about cold fronts or when the weather's right or whatever, outside of just the wind direction, like what are the days that you're saying, okay, I have to be in the woods when this is the scenario?
I think a cold front, any of the last 10 days of October, if you can get in the woods that day, that's huge. 2021, I mean, it was a clear cut cold front coming. It was hitting on a Friday, and it was a day that I had scheduled to work, and I saw it coming, and I talked to the guys. We made arrangements. I think it was the 22nd or 23rd of October, and I ended up getting the day off. And I had bucks hitting the scrape in daylight fairly frequently. And I knew that if I could get there, I had a good crack. And sure enough, I got in there and killed, you know, my target buck the first morning in that spot that year on the first cold front late October. So that's a big one. Northwest winds, I got a couple spots that, you know, if you get a northwest wind accompanied with a cold front, that I always like to give a sit and that I usually see, you know, good activity. I don't know. It just varies depending. You know, the whole month of October, it's basically cold fronts. And in November, for me, it's more about, I guess, winds and pressure. But like high pressure, you know, I'll get way more aggressive if it's high pressure, cold temperatures. You know, bluebird skies, knowing that those thermals are going to be picking up. And you really don't have to worry too much about your scent, you know, crash into some areas, you know, on marginal winds and stuff like that, where I wouldn't typically do it earlier in the season. Well, just, you know, stuff I've, you know, learned over the years. I think the biggest thing I've changed in the last, you know, 6 or 7 years is paying attention to access a lot more. You know, it's one thing to be have the right wind for the tree you're in, but you got to get there, you know. So it's all about how you get there and what you spook on the way in and all. There's some spots that I won't even go to unless there's a 10 or 15 mile an hour wind, you know, for an afternoon set, because you just can't get there because it's one of those, another one of the skinny cover type spots where, you know, you just alert everything in the area that you're there. So a lot of different things I look for and think about every time I go in.
So on those, you had mentioned that you were getting the trail cam pictures of these bucks, daylighting on the scrapes. Let's say that same cold front's coming in and you've got areas that have good deer in there, but you don't have the trail cam pictures. Would you still be setting up on that same scrape, or are there other like terrain features or other things like that time of year that you like to target as well?
Oh, there's a lot of areas I don't have cameras, you know, because I got a lot of ground. So, I mean, I'm not going to, if I got a camera, now historically, I don't put cameras like right over sets. That one set was an exception because I leave a cell cam on a solar panel year round. So the camera's there year round. And I think the deer are just accustomed to it because it's been there for 2 years now. But anyway, if I didn't have bucks coming to that scrape, I would not have went to that spot that day. I would have found another spot. I would have gone somewhere else that historically has been good over the years, but I definitely, you know, if I had a camera there not giving me any intel, I probably wouldn't have went to that exact spot.
Well, I guess I'm trying to like parse it out for like the listener, for myself. Like, so if I don't hunt cold fronts, right? But so this year I say, okay, I'm going to take what Derek said, and, you know, I've heard a lot of other guys talk about like, oh, you got to be in the woods, but being in the woods and being in the right spot are two completely different things. So what to you is like a good spot on a cold front?
It depends on the time of year. You know, first half of October, I'd say get on a food source because the deer are going to be on their feet feeding earlier. And even into later October too, but I try to key more in on, I'm looking for specific bucks, and I try to get in the core areas and get aggressive. I do a lot more calling in late October, especially grunting. I've grown a lot of bucks in the last week of October. So I try to get as close as I can to where I think my target buck is in his core area without, you know, busting him out of there that time of year, and just get aggressive. And then, you know, late season, same thing, you know, you get back on food and you have to start talking December, you know, November, middle of November during the rut, it's all about travel corridors and, you know, just putting the odds in your favor down inside of bedding, travel corridors between bedding, just about being in the woods in general. That, you know, for me, it's, you know, early it would be food, and then later it's more on, you know, specific buck, just getting close, just knowing that because it's a cold front, he's probably more apt to be up on his feet for longer periods of time.
So for myself, I think I've seen more like success, more deer. I'm more confident like during the rut, just, and I feel like it's kind of funny because I feel like, you know, it's one of those things where anybody can get lucky during the rut. So that's why I've been successful then. But it's like, you just get downwind of doe bedding. Right. And, you know, there's going to be deer, find the does. If you can find the does, there's going to be bucks, you know, somewhere around there. And this past year, it was like very unpredictable. Like there was more bucks than there were does, and there was just bucks running around everywhere, but they weren't predictable, right? They were just everywhere, just trying to get on these does. How does that change for you in that pre-rut time frame where it isn't like going crazy? The calling is obviously working for you, but are you still on the downwind side of bedding? Are you trying to look for buck bedding? Are you just on travel corridor? You know, that's where I think for the guys that are trying to improve as hunters or to level up, it becomes really, really tricky because your mind's telling you, well, you should be here. Well, you saw them over there, but there's tracks here. You know, that's where it gets difficult.
So yeah, I'm more focused on where I think the bucks are bedded in the pre-rut, but I don't, necessarily go downwind of it because they're smart. You know, the bucks I'm hunting are at least most of them, I think, are smart. They're probably not going to walk out the downwind side of their bedding area, you know. So I try to use structure or edges or some sort of terrain feature that forces them, you know, to not walk in a straight line where you can kind of get on a, you know, a half off wind or a crosswind where, you know, you're making the wind seem like it's in their favor, but it's not, kind of thing. So it's hard to describe, but I wouldn't just go downwind of buck bedding areas. I don't think that's going to be a, you know, super successful. Like I said, because I just don't think they're going to leave that way. They're going to leave with the wind in their face if they can. Now, obviously, you know, I've had this discussion with buddies before about, you know, if you get a predominant wind and it sticks for 3-4 days in a row, deer's not going to walk in the same direction for 4 days in a row. It's just not possible. So at some point, they got to walk with the wind. You know, they're not always going to have the wind in their favor. But generally, when they're leaving the bed to come out and start, you know, patrolling their area or go hit a food source, they're going to try to get the wind in their favor as much as they can. So I just try to use, like I said, whether it's a down tree, a pond, something that forces them to make a move on that route, you know, to put that in my favor.
So yeah, that makes sense. I think about that more. I guess I don't really ever think about that from a from when I'm normally hunting. I've heard like that's what the stick bow guys use, right? For any deer is, you know, they can't shoot 30-40 yards, so they can't cover more than one trail. So they get to an area where the deer comes out and it has to go around this deadfall. It has to go around. So it's just, they're hunting like these micro pinches so that they're right there for a, you know, inside of a 20 yard, 15 yard shot. And so what you're saying is that you're just getting like where the buck's going to exit. And this is kind of where you hear like the Dan Infaults and those guys talk about, you know, getting super aggressive and getting just off wind where, you know, if that deer gets past that shooting lane or it makes it around that pond, well, now you're busted because your wind is there. You got to kill them right where they're adjusting their movement, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it can cost you too. I'm sure, you know, and a lot of times you don't know. I mean, if you're on an off wind and it swirls whatsoever and they get you and go out the other side, then, you know, they don't always blow at you. So you don't know, you know, I probably get had more often than I'd like to think, but it's worked. And, you know, like you said, the micro pinches and micro reroutes and stuff like that, I guess that, you know, that is something that I noticed that, you know, when I'm scouting with other people that I'm always, you know, they don't really think about usually until I point it out. You know, hey, see that down tree right there? Look at that trail, the way it cuts around it. You know, there's a spot where you might be able to take advantage of them. And, you know, just stuff like that. I mean, I got good buddies that they're very successful. And when we scout, we're on two totally different wavelengths. I mean, I don't understand what they're looking at. They got the same token, and they're not really picking up on what I'm laying down either. So there's more than one way to go about it, for sure. But that kind of stuff's worked for me.
So when you were talking about, you know, the discussion with your buddies and saying that deer aren't going to leave their bed the same way, you know, for 3-4 days in a row. Where does that put you as far as like, so you know that there's a deer in the area, maybe you've got, you know, maybe you've been hunting and you've still got cell cam pictures of them after dark or, you know, coming back to bed or any of that stuff or dog and does or whatever. So, you know, he's still in the area, that you haven't blown him out. Where are you at with sitting the same area, the same tree, the same set, multiple days in a row?
I try to avoid that at all costs other than like in November. I will, if I'm on really good movement and there's a lot of does in that area and I know there's a couple good bucks, I feel like it's a matter of time unless, you know, if I sense that I'm seeing less and less deer every time, I'll give it a rest. But if I'm on deer and it's hot and heavy and I, you know, I got the right conditions to go back in there, I will in November. In October, I bounce around as much as I can, basically taking shots at, you know, multiple different deer because it's rare that I see a deer that I'm after that I'm not in the right spot, I guess, if that makes sense. It seems like when I get a good encounter with one, more often than not, I'm successful with it. But if it doesn't work, you know, usually I'm on to the next deer, the next hunt, basically, or, you know, I'll go back after that one a week later or 5 days later or whatever it might be and try it again, or a little bit different setup on the other side of the same bedding area or whatever it might be. But I like to bounce around a lot in October for sure.
So it sounds like you've got a bunch of spots to hunt, a bunch of area, a bunch of options. But like I said, I'm not familiar with that style of hunting on private land. Like, do you think that there's any downfalls to the way that you're doing it, or things that are the difficulties that you face that maybe somebody that hunts public or something that doesn't, you know, maybe has a misconception of, you know, just how easy it is on private?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I don't have the private all to myself. You know, I'm not saying it's public, but I am hunting with 10 other guys, basically. So, you know, we have a lot of grounds, but there is other pressure. I don't know that there's a downfall to what I do, you know, the way I hunt. I don't, like I said, I usually don't get super aggressive until it's time to get aggressive. So I don't feel like I put a ton of pressure on areas and I'm hurting anybody else's hunts, you know, really the way I hunt. I'm not sure on that. I know that, I don't think there's a downfall to the way I hunt. I wish I could, you know, visually see the deer more early. Like if I had more time off to glass from a distance and really pinpoint them early, I guess I wish I could do that more, but I don't know. I'm sure I affect the deer more, like I said earlier, more than I think I do. But everybody does, I think.
So you talked, kind of when we started this about, shooting, a buck on like your first year hunting with a bow. And then, you know, it wasn't long after that before you said you started really starting to figure out the deer, and all of that. At what point or was there like a deer, that you either saw or that you killed that, kind of made you turn the corner for like going after like age class, like 3-4 year old bucks?
Yeah, sort of. And when I started hunting, I mean, there wasn't talk of, you know, shooter bucks. It was a buck was a shooter, you know, growing up. So I shot a lot of bucks, a lot of young bucks growing up. But I think it gave me that killer instinct, you know, made me better in those situations. You know, I see a lot of customers and a lot of young hunters nowadays that are, you know, they're passing bucks, never shot a buck, they're waiting for a big one. You know, and then they finally get that first opportunity and, you know, they're not ready for it because they haven't ever done it before. So I think there's something to be said about getting some kills under your belt. But right around, I think I was 20 or 21, and I had killed, I don't know, 6 or 8 years in a row, I had killed a buck at least, if not two, with a bow. And it just got to the point where, you know, I just wanted to start challenging myself to try to, you know, try to kill nicer deer. And just so happened that opening day that particular year, I was on a spot that I'd never hunted before. It was in kind of an old dried up marsh, and I was only maybe 10, 11 feet off the ground because it was all the cover allowed me to get. And I wasn't in a tree a half hour, and here come two bucks. And historically, you know, the bigger of the two, you know, it was still probably a year and a half old, maybe a 2 year old, but it was a 7 pointer. Historically, I would have shot that deer and I would have been ecstatic and, you know, and moved on from there. And I, you know, told myself, you know, you're going to let this deer go, and, you know, you're going to wait for something bigger. Let them go. They came right by 5 yards, walked by, they left. Half hour, 45 minutes later, I looked to my left and the biggest buck I'd ever gotten a crack at was standing at 35 yards. And moving through the shooting lane, and I drew back. He got to the second shooting lane, and I. 4 in the morning, red
Join me, Chef Jean-Paul Bourgeois, and the whole crew here at Duck Camp Dinners every Monday at 8 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV.
Freaking smoked them, and kind of the rest was history. You know, it was all lesson in one hunt. You know, I could have shot a buck, you know, half hour, 45 minutes earlier, and ended up letting him walk it. I was rewarded with a bigger one. So at the time, you know, it was my biggest buck. It was like 115-inch, three-year-old 8-point. It wasn't nothing spectacular. For me at the time, it was, because I was so used to, you know, just shooting a 7-pointer or a 5-pointer or whatever came by. And, you know, that kind of opened my eyes. And from then, I started getting a lot more selective and didn't shoot as many deer for a few years until I started, you know, 2005, 2006, I started hunting out of state a little bit. And then in 2009 is when I picked up the area I'm at in Michigan, and have, you know, been pretty successful since that time frame.
So prior to that hunt, prior to that sit, prior to that kill, had you had encounters with bigger bucks or older age class bucks and it just didn't work out? Or was that the first, like, kind of all came to fruition?
I had seen a few, not very many though. I mean, not a lot. I mean, I was basically a kid, you know, growing up. I was, at that time, I was 21, but I'm still kind of a kid. I had seen a few for sure. I had some buddies that had shot some nice bucks, but I hadn't, you know, I think I had one good buck win me maybe when I was 16 or 17. You know, he winded me before I even saw him, blew and took off. I saw a big rack running away. I'll never forget that. That was the first, like, gut punch I ever took hunting. But I hadn't really had a lot of encounters with good deer, to be honest with you, until then. And then I kind of just slowly evolved from there to, you know, I've shot, you know, quite a few good deer, like I said now. But yeah, it was almost like just an overnight change for me, just the whole mentality.
Yeah, I think that's the difference. And one of the things for me this year, like, I'm not much of a goal setter. I'll say, okay, this is what I want to do. But when it comes down to it, I think it's probably that I don't put in enough work. You know, I put in the sits, but I'm just not, like, finding the deer and, like, targeting a deer, because I really do, you know, and obviously hunting public is, a different, animal somewhat, so to speak, but I like being surprised, you know, and I think you can put out trail cameras and be like, okay, I thought there would be deer here or whatever. But I mean, I know it doesn't matter if it's public, private, whatever. We've all had the experience where you go in and you look and you say, this looks like a spot where I could kill a buck, or there's going to be deer, and the validation of when it happens, right? Like, probably the same scenario that you had when that other big buck popped out and you were like, I was right. You know, that whole, you know, satisfaction of, like, of being correct there. But that same thing is, like, kind of what you had alluded to before, is I feel like a lot of guys, and myself included, like, if you're not shooting your bow a lot and you're not putting yourself in these situations and even getting drawn back on deer or whatever, you end up with that first shot either being a miss, or you make a bad shot on them. And then after that, as the season progresses, you're saying, like, you know, don't mess it up, instead of saying, you know, oh, you're dead. You know, there's a lot of mental stuff that goes into it. And, you know, I think a lot of guys have maybe too much confidence going into it. Like the young guys, like, where, you know, I'm going to hold off for a 140 and you're, you know, hunting Northern Michigan or wherever, where it's, you know, there's not a whole lot of them running around. And if they are, everybody else and their brother's hunting them too, right? So I think that's a really good hunt, you know, for you get the satisfaction and you get, you know, validation all in one, like, fell swoop, you know?
There's no better feeling than being rewarded on, you know, all the work you put in. you know, but I don't know. That's what keeps me coming back, is that feeling when it pays off for sure.
Well, and I think one of the things that I, you know, we probably say it on here too much, but I think what I love about archery and bow hunting is, like, can be summed up when guys say, like, oh, even those two deer that you let walk by at 5 yards, you know, you said, well, I could have killed them. Well, there's lots of things that can go wrong between, you know, drawing your bow and, you know, the grip and grin, right? So many times guys say, well, you know, I could have smoked this one this morning. Well, we've all been in that scenario where it was absolutely perfect and we forgot to move our pin, or the arrow fell off the rest, or we hit a branch, or all of those things. And to me, that's the ultimate. That's why I love the archery hunting versus rifle hunting or anything like that, is because, you know, we can think it would have went perfectly, but it's everything changes once that arrow gets released. Oh, yeah. Right.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I get buddies to tell me they passed this deer. I'm like, oh, yeah, how far? It's like, oh, 50 yards. I'm like, you didn't pass them. You didn't have a good opportunity. I mean, you didn't really pass them. You know, there's so many variables. Yeah, it's I've had a couple encounters where you think they're slam dunks. I had a buck a couple years ago at 22 yards, drew back, put the pin right behind the shoulder, let it rip, and then 2 feet over his back. Dawned on me about 5 minutes later that my sight was at 59 yards, you know, so it just, you know, stuff like that happens and you can never anticipate it. And that shit, even something like that, where I, you know, for all intents and purposes, I made a good shot, just had the sight misset, you know, got bumped when I was walking in because it's a slider sight, but it shot my confidence. I was down in the dumps, so I was wondering if I could still, you know, thoughts start going through your mind. Can I do this? You know, is everything okay? You know, was that the end for you? You know, there's a lot of thought that goes into it. And then, you know, until you kill the next one, and then it's back, you know, it's all about confidence, and nothing leaves them more confidence than success, for sure.
So, and we can wrap this up here, pretty soon, but, one of the things that you said when you were talking about, you know, going out there and hunting with confidence for, you know, that 17-year-old, 18-year-old Derek, and, you know, for a guy who maybe didn't have the property that you had to hunt, like, what were you drawing on from that confidence in those early years?
Just my scouting and, you know, the sign I saw, and I knew I could, I've always, like I said, kind of had natural instincts in the woods. When I had an opportunity, I always made most on them. And, you know, I always was able to set my expectations based on where I was hunting. So when I didn't have the ground I have now, you know, I would have been happy with, you know, a nice 8 point. You know, any 8 point was a nice buck, you know, so you just got to be confident in what you see and trust it. And, you know, set your expectations accordingly. And if you're not hunting an area that has a big bucks, don't expect to kill a big buck. You know, if I was hunting in the UP, I'd be happy to kill a 100-inch buck. You know, I'd be ecstatic. Down here where I hunt in southern Michigan, I'm letting 120-inch deer go by. So it's all about setting expectations, trusting what you know and what you've done, and, you know, going on it. And being happy whether you're successful or not, really.
And I think it sounds like you're almost talking about, like, from a hunting standpoint, like building a portfolio, right? Like your resume doesn't start with, you know, the job you have right now. Like, you didn't just luck into this manager job or running a pro shop. Like, you had to be the guy that was painting arrows. You had to be the guy that was sitting there watching and doing all that stuff. And that applies to the hunting side too, is like, you don't just go out and kill 140s, 150s consistently, yeah, without, you know, killing anything up 100%. To that point.
Yeah, it goes hand in hand. You can't just jump right in and go right to the top in either realm, whether it's hunting or, you know, work industry, whatever you're doing. You got to work your way up. And, you know, like I said before, you know, there's a lot of young guys, especially, that feel like they're going to jump right to the top and, you know, shoot a booner every year. You know, they got to get, it just doesn't happen like that. You know, you gotta get some kills on your belt, learn the, you know, the habits of the deer, why they do what they do. You know, learn when, what you can get away with in the tree, what you can't get away with. There's so many things you can learn, you know, even with spikes, you know, does, you name it. I mean, so many things you can learn, you know, harvesting them out. It's hard to explain, but it definitely helps.
Oh, for sure.
And I'm not saying, you know, I'm not telling everybody to go out and whack two spikes every year. You know, I just, like, you got to start somewhere, you know.
Well, and I think you have to even start before that and put in the work to find a deer, any deer. And I think that's where, that's certainly where I need to, improve on, is not just putting all my eggs in one basket over here and then saying, well, I know there's deer over there, and then having the same expectations. Like, you know, when you say that you start with, you know, 15 or 20 bucks and then they narrow them down or even more than that, you know, that I think that kind of puts it in perspective, as far as how you kind of narrow it down and get to that point. It doesn't just, you know, it's not like, well, I got this piece of private, and we have this discussion lots of times. Like, would you rather be the guy that has an entire basement full of 150s, but you only hunt the same stand, the same bean field every year, and you know, like, between this date and this date, one's going to walk out and you just shoot them, but you couldn't go kill a spike on public ground to save your life? Or would you rather have half the deer and a third of the inches, but be able to kill a deer wherever you walked on, you know? And it's like, you got to be able to have some skills.
Yeah, there's a lot of relativity in hunting. I mean, you're only as good as the place you can hunt. I mean, that's a fact. You can kill a big deer if there are big deer there. And guys like yourself that hunt public, I have a lot of respect for guys that can consistently kill deer in public. I've never even tried it. I'm intimidated by it. It's just not me. Now, maybe someday I'll get to the point where I have to do that, but right now it's just, it's hard to do when I have, you know, places to hunt that I do have to hunt. And it's different, you know, like you were saying, I'm not shooting a deer in the same tree every year after year after year. So every year it's a little bit different for the most part. And I definitely have a lot of respect for those guys that hunt those, you know, public land especially.
Yeah, it's a ton of fun. I mean, I can tell you that it's equally frustrating. But it's very fulfilling. And I think for me, it's the getting out there and learning and doing all of that sort of stuff. But I don't know. I also don't hunt for the look at me type. I would say probably hunting maybe does somewhat define me. Like I would define myself as a hunter, but the deer that I kill or the amount of inches don't make the person that I am. And I think a lot of people try and hang their hat on, like, they have to do this, otherwise they're a failure or whatever. And like I said before, like, goals are great and stuff like that, but, you know, I don't identify with the deer that I kill.
Yeah. I'm kind of there too. I've gotten to the point, I kind of crossed the bridge maybe 5 years ago where I no longer felt like I need to kill a deer. I don't feel like I have to kill a deer to be that guy anymore. I'm almost more proud of what I don't shoot than what I do shoot anymore. As much as I love, you know, texting 50 of my buddies when I kill one, I mean, it's almost just as cool to send them a video, hey, check this buck out there, that walk, you know. So it's kind of it was an interesting transition. I feel like I went through about 5 years ago when I just didn't feel like I had to kill one to validate myself anymore. I think it made me a better hunter, honestly.
Well, I think it makes you, I think, more appreciative, you know, and you're not like pressing, as I feel like the more pressure that I've not shot like any competitive archery or anything like that, but I think with anything, like the more pressure you put on yourself, like, oh, I have to do this. Kind of like what we were talking about with the deer, like, you know, the difference between like being like so calm, being like, this deer is going to die, and being like, don't mess it up. Like, it's a lot more peaceful and a lot more, you know, you're able to appreciate the time more.
Put pressure on yourself, it makes it not as much fun, for sure. I mean, it makes it feel like work.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting for guys that like us, and you know, you're work at the bow shop, you've only got so many days to hunt. Like, it kind of seem ridiculous that you would pass deer like that, because you only have so much time. And then for guys that do a hunting show or have like a platform or, you know, podcast or whatever, like, you would think that the pressure is like, oh, we have to kill something, but it's not why we're doing it. First of all, like, we're doing it for ourselves and because it's what we love to do, not for what anybody else thinks. And I think a lot of people miss that.
Yeah, for sure. I just don't feel like killing another 120-inch deer. I'm not saying I won't shoot another 120-inch deer. You know, some 120-inch deer might be a 5-year-old. You just never know. And that might be a deer I probably want to target. But I just don't feel like I just don't need the validation of stacking more of those versus giving them a chance to get a year older, and maybe they're 140 next year at this point. It means more to me than, you know, taking that particular deer. But like I said, I just don't feel like I need that, you know, rah-rah moment to send them home. You know,
so what's next for you? Like, I mean, what are you're kind of, how long is it going to be until you can hunt out of state, or you can say, all right, I'm going to have to leave the shop to go on that elk hunt or to do something like that?
I bought my first Colorado preference point this year, so it's on the radar. I'd like to do that in the next 5 years, Colorado elk hunt, or unless something else better opportunity comes up. But I am doing Indiana out of state, but that's in November. And then next year I'm going to Iowa, but that's, again, that's a November hunt. But sometime in the next 5 years, I'd like to get out of state, out west, and, you know, in the busy season at the shop, I guess.
Okay. Well, we're definitely going to be following along with you to see, and we'll have to catch up after the season and kind of get maybe more into some of the hunts and how it went for you this year. So what shop again is it that you work at? Like, how can people get a hold of you if they need bow work done or any of that stuff?
I'm at Sunrise Archery in Fenton, Michigan. We're over in Genesee County, right off of US 23, exit 80. Phone number is 810-936-0066. We're there 6 days a week. We're closed on Sundays. Otherwise, we're pretty much there, other than holidays, you know, all year round. 10 to 6 during the week, 10 to 4 on Saturday.
And like, as far as like social media, or if anybody wants to follow along with you or the shop, where can they do that?
Yeah, we're on Facebook and Instagram, just Sunrise Archery. We do have a website, sunrisearchery.com. My wife actually runs all of our social media for the last 3.5 years or so. That's been a big help for us. We've had a big increase in
that. Awesome. Well, just thank you again for coming on tonight, and appreciate you taking the time and chatting with me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, no problem.
Hey everyone, Will Cooper here, host of Hunt Stand's Make Your Mark podcast. Join us as we dive deep into the world of hunting and outdoor pursuits. We've brought together some of the most accomplished individuals in the industry to share their invaluable insights and experiences with you. But here's the kicker. It's not just about hunting tips and tactics. We're exploring how you can carve your own path, elevate your skills, and gain some wisdom from the best in the field. So whether you're a seasoned hunter looking to fine-tune your skills or a newbie eager to learn, our podcast has something for everyone. Stay tuned for more exciting guests and hotter topics. Don't miss out and subscribe to Hunt Stand's Make Your Mark podcast today and start making your mark in the great outdoors.
In wild country, rules were not created by man. Don't miss Wild Country, Wednesdays from 7 to 11 p.m. Eastern. Presented by Primos. Speak the language. Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment.